Hi, and welcome to this week's VFX show. I'm Mike Seymour, and I'm joined by David. How are you, David?
I'm quite well. Yourself?
Pretty good. I'm sort of glad to be back. I've been, 16 ways from Sunday, all around the world, as they say. So, it's nice to be home. I've been shooting in China, and I've been doing stuff in Adelaide, and man, it's nice to be back in the office.
It's always weird how traveling always seems so fun, but always the best part is coming back home.
Oh yeah, totally. What about you? Do you have a good 4th of July?
I did. I attempted to write an entire script in one weekend and failed miserably, but had a good time nonetheless.
Okay. That seems like a fairly daunting prospect. Now, today's webcast, I was going to call it a podcast, but I should call it a webcast, I guess. We're looking at The Incredible Hulk, and I guess this is of particular interest for a couple of reasons, and one of the things that might interest you in light of your writing is the fact that the star also had a hand in the screenplay.
Ed Norton, who I think when a lot of people heard that, they were like, oh, typical Hollywood person, you know, butting their nose in where it doesn't belong. But Ed Norton's been known as kind of a script doctor for quite a while. He does a lot of, you know, off-the-record writing and punch-up on a lot of scripts. So
I actually think he's fantastic. He's, like, really talented. For years now, anything that he's done, I've been happy to see. Is it American History X? Was that...
American History X, Fight Club. He's
Fight
an
Club,
amazing actor.
Obviously an obvious one, but American History X, which is just such a good film, and so incredibly upsetting at times as a film, just stunning performance. So yeah, I was actually the opposite. I was when I heard that he had something to do with the writing, I thought that it was might actually make the film worth seeing. Because prior to that, I was pretty down on the whole idea of it being reimagined, restarted, rebooted, re-whatever the current euphemism is for let's try and milk more money from this one.
Yeah, the reboot itself, the fact that they're doing it so soon kind of surprised me. You know, we've had reboots of James Bond and Batman and Superman recently, but, you know, Ang Lee's Hulk was only, what, 4 years ago?
And truly an appalling use of a great actor, because Eric Banner is really good. In Black Hawk Down, he's magnificent. You know, there's so many good things that he's done, but that wasn't one of them. That was a really bad film.
Yeah, I think it was a little bit too... I think when you have a Hulk trailer and the title card they put up is from the director of Sense and Sensibility, you know you're in trouble.
Yes, yes. Whereas the director here had done a bunch of things, including Transporter, which is much more kind of the ilk of a movie that you'd expect. And this is another Marvel-funded film, isn't it? This is pretty much in the same zone as Iron Man.
It is, and it's immediately kind of showing the benefits of funding their own movies by having the little cameo there at the end.
Yeah, yeah. It's certainly a hint that there's a combined film coming, isn't there?
Yes.
So what did you think of this this version of The Incredible Hulk?
I have to say I was quite pleasantly surprised. You know, I went in without any expectations one way or the other, and I was just kind of sat back and really, really quite enjoyed it. And actually what I thought was much like Iron Man, while the effects were, I thought, pretty darn good, and the action sequences were fantastic. It was kind of the quiet moments. The all the stuff that happened in Brazil, I thought, was in the favela, was just really engaging as a character piece. I thought it was funny. I thought it was well paced. I thought it was really a darn good movie.
I would actually pull up on saying it's a darn good movie. I'd say it was pretty good. I think. Edward Norton was... there were some good actors in it, right? Like, I really think that William Hurt did a good job, and, you know, Edward Norton, as I already said, I'm really... But I actually thought the film was brilliant in Brazil and pathetic by the end. I'm not talking about the visual... Well, I'm partly talking about the visual effects, but the Abomination, that whole... I read, I think, in Cinefix, where it was described as Any Given Sunday on steroids, and I'd have to say it wasn't. Like, Any Given Sunday is a magnificent film, just absolutely on the edge of your seat, magnificent. And once you get these absurdly, ridiculously over-the-top, can-do-anything kind of fight sequences, I mean, I'm really just waiting for the film to finish. There's no question in my mind that the Hulk's going to win. It's ridiculous, it's over-the-top, it's boring, and it's meant to be really exciting, and I just found it just... I it's partly a problem that you just, what do you do? But, and partly the problem that they always want to have this big dramatic ending where people pick up cars and throw them right, left and centre. It just didn't work for me. I'm sorry. Did you like the ending? That whole fight at the end?
I liked it. I thought it could have been a lot shorter than it was and still have been quite effective. The filmmaker in me kind of looks at that going, I think... people were so disappointed with Ang Lee's Hulk, you know, the fact of the lack of a Hulk smash fest in the first movie, they decided to kind of make up for it in this one by kind of going overboard. So I thought, you know, with all these movies, you know, there's going to be the big, huge fight between at the end between the two villains. And it was, I thought it was great. I just thought it went on a little bit too long.
Okay, so we've established in earlier episodes that you read the comic books, right? So tell me, yes. Does every comic book end with a version of the hero that's evil matching the hero? Because, I mean, isn't this Iron Man just replicated? In Iron Man, he finds another suit that looks like the first suit. They have a big fight out. The big suit is bigger than the hero suit. The guy's the underdog, doesn't look like he's going to win. Big fight, smash lots of stuff. Oh, by the way, he won. I mean, isn't that exactly what happened in Hulk?
Yeah, it is exactly what happened in Hulk, and ironically, we were having this conversation at work about 2 weeks before Hulk came out, that I was saying I thought it was a little bit too similar. But the issue, I guess, comes into is with all these comic book movies, is almost every single superhero always has kind of a dark version of themselves as their arch nemesis. You know, Spider-Man has Venom. You can kind of go through the whole list of them and their counterpart of being their kind of yang to their yin.
Let's look at, say, a film that, like, The Fantastic Four, right, with the Silver Surfer. That wasn't that. They had a character. There was something going on with that character. Character had some reason, some thought behind it, even though it looked initially like it was just out to kill everybody. It was related to, like, that was a more complicated end battle solve problem, and right, it's still cartoony.
Yes, but the Silver Surfer wasn't the first movie. You have to remember the first Fantastic Four movie was Doctor Doom, and Doctor Doom, for while his powers are different in the comic books, and just he is, you know, the evil genius to Richard Reed's good genius. A lot of people, when Spider-Man was announced, the movie, they were a little surprised that Venom wasn't going to be the hero in it, because he's kind of become Spider-Man's iconic arch nemesis. So it's in the first movie, you know, it was Hulk versus his dad, and I think a lot of people were disappointed by that, and the only kind of other...
But I don't think they were disappointed with him being against his dad. I think they were disappointed that a guy that looked like he had a beer gut was skipping across mountaintops.
I think there was a lot of issues with the first movie.
I mean, the skipping thing in the first one, the physical lack of weight, I mean, it was just... And, you know, it's like ILM, so it's obviously it come from the director. It's not like they're bad at visual effects. Now, Rhythm and Hughes does the Hulk in this one, and I think they do the Hulk really well. My problem is the Abomination, the guy he's up against, right? Like, why? What is this exoskeleton thing with the spine that everybody's into? Like, I just feel like it's been done. Like, I just don't feel like we're seeing stuff that's original and breathtakingly interesting, and I can't believe that the comic books are this dull, that they all have the same premise, same story, same finale.
Yeah, having read comic books, I can believe they can be this dull sometimes. I completely hear what you're saying and agree on a lot of levels, but I think that for the reboot of it, that they had to give diehard Hulk fans what they wanted. And as to the design of the Abomination, I can't fault Rhythm and Hughes for that, because they're just executing what the production designer gives them.
But this film gave the Hulk stuff in that battle in the university. That was good. That was, you know, I mean, I'm not after like Shakespeare. That was a fun kind of battle. The stuff in South America was brilliant. I just think that the film had everything going for it, and then it was like tack on end. Hero battle, carry on, blah blah, go to sleep. Can the film finish now, please? Can I want to see the end titles?
I absolutely hear what you're saying, and I agree 90% of with what you're saying. I think you need that end battle, but I think it went on too long.
I just think I'm praying that the rumors that Ed Norton had a different ending and that wasn't the one that he wrote is true. Now, he didn't write the whole thing. He kind of did a rewrite of the thing in record time, I think. But still, it just felt to me like if somebody told me that Ed Norton had been involved in writing everything up until the bit at the end when he jumps out of the helicopter, I'd have bought it. I'd have completely believed that to be true. I don't know that to be the fact, but it just felt like get to the jump out of the helicopter and it's goodbye interesting script. Hello, we've seen it before. And I don't want to, you know, go on about it, but I just feel like, whereas, you know, the earlier stuff, chasing through the streets and the whole idea of him being worried about his blood and the bottle and the you know, just the subtext of trying to control his anger, and there's a nice amount of jokes, but not so much that it's just corny. It was great. It was fun watching the SAS team chasing him and being concerned about him turning into the Hulk and trying to manage his, you know, pulse rate until finally with that the guys from the factory, and it's like, you know, you don't want to go there, and then you don't see Hulk so much in the factory, right? You just see the damage that he does, and it plays so well.
That factory scene is just utterly brilliantly done.
Yeah, built up to it. The effects were really good. You know, when he throws the, whatever that is, the forklift truck and stuff, it was exciting, it was interesting, it was not stupid, but obviously it was, you know, incredible, if that makes sense. So...
To kind of wrap up the whole end, the third act, I guess you could say, I think probably the script said, Hulk and Abomination fight through the streets of New York. And that was the end of it. Kind of going back to the old joke about the movie Fort Apache, where there's one line in the script supposedly that said, and the Indians take the fort, and that's 45 minutes on screen.
And what is it about New York? Like, if anyone wants to blow up anything, kill anything, smash anything, from Cloverfield to I don't know what, it's New York. New Yorkers must just generally, like, be kind of getting sick of seeing their city getting trashed, poor people. Like, I've been in New York. It's a nice place. Has interesting art. I just feel like every time you want to have a smash up, you got to have it in the streets of New York. Anyway,
I think we can mention I Am Legend.
It gets flooded. It gets smashed. Yeah. So anyway, let's just discuss the visual effects for a second, and I'll sort of get off my hobby horse about the third act, because really, just from character design to everything. Oh God. Yeah, I don't even know how you'd start to make that better other than just start from scratch. But let's discuss the actual design of the Hulk for a second. It's been, obviously, ever since the TV show, the fact that the Hulk doesn't look like the actor himself kind of bulked up. It's always, you know, obviously it was a different double in the TV show. And he had a nice cameo in this one. But what did you actually think about the digital Hulk?
I thought it was really well done, actually. I kind of liked a lot of the in-jokes that they did with the whole purple pants thing. I thought he looked, fairly plausible. The big problem with Hulk has always been, well, two things. One, people that big, it's so close to being human size, but still so extremely not human that you kind of are already in a weird area. You know, it's, you kind of get off easier if Hulk was 16 feet tall instead of just 9 feet tall, because all the proportions are just slightly bigger. And of course you have the problem with the green skin, which is the complete antithesis of, you know, human, pink fleshy insides. You know, you have the whole green blood, you know, I'm not, don't want to get into any issues of, you know, skin color, but what I'm talking about is like the insides of your skin, no matter what, you know, we're all the same on the inside.
Right.
But with the Hulk, he's, whereas we're green, or whereas we're red on the inside when we get, our blood becomes oxidized, his is green. So it's so unnatural that having it pull off and look real is a challenge, you know?
Well, I thought the whole idea of having him kind of more olive and less fluoro green was a good move. I thought that was just, you know, like it played well, I thought. His tonality was good.
And, you know, originally the Hulk wasn't even green. He was gray. Oh, yeah. The Hulk was originally gray, and he occasionally went back to gray in the comic books. And at times in the movie, he, you know, the kind of deeper folds of his skin looked gray. And I thought he looked really fantastic. I thought he was a little bit veiny at times, but I know that in particular was a look that Louis Leterrier, the director, was going after.
Yeah, I definitely think that the digital rendering of his skin, just in terms of texturing and stuff, was really, really good. Like there are some close up shots of him, and you get to see. I know what you mean about the veining stuff, but there are some great musculature stuff going on there. You know, like really fabulous. Because obviously it has to be incredibly well, theoretically low percentage body fat, ripped muscles showing through to the skin. And it did have a sense of the texture being of a larger beast. You know what I mean? Like a hint of elephant, a hint of rhino, a hint of something else that is a bigger, more weathered kind of beast than a sort of lush pink soft thing that you associate with it being smaller and stuff. So that fine microscopic kind of texture that they were getting on the skin kind of sold it as being bigger. So I think digitally that worked really well. And I think for the most part, apart from this third act that I hate, I think he had weight. I think, you know, in the beat, the, what do you call it, smackdown at the university, he felt heavy to me. He didn't feel like he was, you know, light and sort of, which he obviously needed to feel very heavy.
Yeah, he felt very heavy. His skin, I thought, was just unbelievably fantastic. It's up there with any digital character skin I've seen so far. It looked very touchable. It didn't just look like it had stuff on the surface. It looked like it had a lot of layers to it. And I thought animation wise, the acting they did with him was pretty fantastic. There's a scene in the movie that takes place on this kind of rock outcropping with some really bad looking digital rain that. I thought the acting that they had the Hulk doing in that scene was pretty fantastic.
The only slight problem I had with that scene, and that's where she's sort of curling up with him, right, after the after they've escaped, is I stopped myself from thinking that they'd got the scale wrong. I mean, it just felt like maybe he was like 3/4 normal height rather than his full height because it worked with her beside him. I don't know that they cheated that or not. It felt a bit like they cheated it. Did that strike you? Because in the scenes when he was previously battling the theoretically fairly tall army guys, he felt like double their height, and that, you know, they only came up to his waist kind of thing. So she didn't feel that proportionately small. Is that something that you read or not?
It did. That was the one scene that did strike me, because I know one of the things they were very conscious of in this movie. And again, getting back to Ang Lee's Hulk, the one of the things that Ang Lee did in that movie was that the Hulk supposedly got bigger the angrier he got. So he would be different, you know, he was different scales in almost every single shot, which kind of confused people. In that particular scene, my guess, because I did, like, when I was watching the movie, I did think he looks a little bit smaller there.
And
I
know
they're. They're trying to definitely make sure he stayed the same size. My guess is, you know, the equivalent of putting an actor on an Apple box on a set, where, you know, while the actors may be, you know, one person may be significantly shorter than the other, and when you're in a long shot and they're walking, you know, you can see that. But yet when they're face to face, you know, they'll suddenly be eye to eye because they'll put the shorter actor on an Apple box just to get the framing right.
Yeah.
So that was my guess, is that they might have like artificially lowered him through the ground or what have you, or scaled him down just a little bit, just to get the framing a little bit more in what the director wanted, which may not have been as effective as it would have been leaving him his normal size and giving that nice juxtaposition.
I guess the risk that you get, and it's my pet hate, right? It's the whole concept of the cheat. It's like when somebody wants something, they say, oh, just cheat it. And the trouble with the cheat is you kind of forget that the whole point of the word is that you're cheating, right? Like, it's not like a magic. Just saying, oh, let's cheat the shot doesn't magically make it work when it's wrong. You just hope that nobody sees that you cheated, if that makes sense. And
yeah.
Sometimes I think directors just say, well, I want them to be better framed, so just cheat it. And as an audience, it's like, well, but the cheat didn't work. Like, I don't buy the cheat. And I've oftentimes, when somebody said just cheat it, it's almost been a like an excuse to say, well, let's nod and a wink, just get it wrong, and we don't care because it's inconvenient to be right at this point in time. And I don't know. I just feel like that if that was the case, if they were cheating it in that shot, then I didn't buy the cheat.
Yeah. My boss has a phrase he likes to use, which is, if it looks right, it is right. And of course, the analog to that would be, if it looks wrong, it is wrong.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's nothing wrong with cheating when you have to cheat, but if your cheat looks like a cheat and you can tell it's a cheat, it's not a cheat. It's a mistake.
It's a mistake, exactly right, yeah. And just calling it a cheat doesn't, you know, somehow miraculously get you past the wrongness of the shot. So in terms of the other things other than the Hulk itself, because it obviously had a lot of interaction with other things, you know, such as the soldiers and the, you know, armory and all the other stuff. And for that matter, the transformation or near transformation on the doctor's table near the end. I thought that was all really well executed. I was really, really pleasantly surprised with how well that kind of sat in there.
Yeah, the interaction between Liv Tyler and the Hulk when he's strapped down to that table was some of the better digital interaction I've seen, not only in terms of, you know, plate interaction, but the way they thought it out, I'm guessing, physically on the set, you know, because you have this guy who's changing shape and changing volume that she's literally on top of.
Yeah,
and she's reacting in a way to his movements underneath her, and it didn't look like they'd stuck her on a poor man's gimbal or you know, just told her to rock back and forth. I'm not sure exactly what they did to get the physical interaction so well done, but it was pretty well done, and her acting really, really sold that.
Yeah, I mean, that is a scene that could have been hokey and looked fake, but not only was her interaction on top of him, but there's some frames where it's still Norton, still his face, but his body has all become kind of weathered green, but not yet fully the Hulk's. Like, it's sort of almost his proportions, but still with the greenish tinge and texture of the Hulk. And I was just, okay, I'm not sure at what point CG is kicking in, or it's a composite over the top, or it's makeup. It was just a really good blend between the two. And yet, you know, most of the time when I see that, I would look at the actor's face and go, well, like, that's just a bad CG face that's lost the kind of humanity of the actor's performance. So I think full marks for that stuff. And I also think full marks for the rigid body dynamic stuff when he's ripping cars apart and using them as boxing gloves and stuff. You know, I never for a second felt the cars, you know, felt fake. I mean, they must have been digitally done, of course, but they felt real. They looked good. And I think, you know, full marks to the guys.
Yeah, I mean, it was, I think a lot of the effects were extremely ambitious in what they wanted to pull off. I know they did a lot of motion capture with my friends over at Giant Studios for the movie, which I think helped in a lot of the acting of the Hulk. But the only digital effect that I kind of saw that bugged me is there were some skies that I thought looked really fake, and again, that rain I thought bugged me a little bit. But all the physical interaction. And I think they also did one piece of digital stuff, which was in that fight at the university. They had what I would assume would be a digital Roth fighting, you know, the human moving extra fast, jumping yep. extra high. And that's so easy to make it look cartoony and fake.
And Bionic Man sped up kind of stuff, yeah.
Yeah, and I thought they pulled that off really well, which is hard because, as you know, you're accustomed to seeing humans move in a certain manner. So
I also think it was great to see Rhythm and Hughes not doing animals, right? Because, like, the poor guys, they're really talented, Rhythm and Hughes. They have been for years. They're just so well known for doing animals and talking animals and stuff that, you know, they're not sort of renowned for their for the rest of the body of the work that they've done, and that's a huge shame. So it was great to see them headlining and doing such a good job. You know,
yeah, they've really been coming on strong for the past couple of years with a lot of their more robust creatures doing it in the first Lion Witch in the Wardrobe movie and such. We're still talking animals for the most part, but they're really turning out some fantastic work these days.
Yeah, I mean, I take nothing away from their work that they've done on those animal type things, because obviously it's brilliant, and Golden Compass and stuff, all great. It's just that, you know, it's great to see them doing some other stuff, and I know that they've got other stuff coming out, Mummy 3 and stuff, but yeah, I think they deserve that. You know, they've been around for a fair while. I mean, this is a company that has earned its stripes in no uncertain terms, and I think, you know, it's a good company, they're good people there, and I'm glad to see them getting lead on stuff that doesn't involve animals. Now,
yeah, on their legacy, I mean, I think, you know, I talk to some people these days coming out of school who kind of buy into the belief that there's really only Pixar, ILM, Sony, or Weta, and there's a lot of other companies out there, and there's, you know, Rhythm and Hughes has a pedigree going back literally to the very origins of computer-generated imagery, you know, going all the way back to Robert Abel and Associates, and I'm glad they're still around. And the other thing I'd like to say about Rhythm and Hughes, having a few friends who've worked there over the years, they are one of the best companies in the industry for how they treat their employees. You know, they do not grind their employees into the ground. They have amazing benefits, and they treat their employees like, you know, real people, and I think that should be applauded. Especially in this day and age where a lot of companies do kind of grind through their employees. So, you know, just want to say hats off to Rhythm and Hughes for finally getting their due and a nice show.
I mean, I think they've had a lot of success. Don't you know, when we say have their due, I mean, I know what you mean, and I totally agree. But by the same token, I mean, obviously, go back to Babe and they won the Oscar, right? So it's like not like they haven't ever been in the spotlight. I just feel like recently, in recent times, as you say, they've not got the same spotlight that some of those other places have. And, you know, it is great to see a company that successfully manages their process, manages their staff, and then year in, year out, for decades, produces high-quality visual effects. Now, having said that, shift gears for a second. Do you want to talk about The Abomination, or should we just agree to just pass on that?
Well, I think Abomination is a successful failure in terms of, I think they very successfully pulled off a failed design. You know, it's kind of like the Edsel, where it didn't matter how nice it was still at its core just poorly designed. It reminded me of every kind of overblown ZBrush design that you see populating the forums, and people who read one too many H.R. Giger books, and Paul Topopoulos designs. You know, it was just a little bit overblown and too bony, too ridgy. You know, just a little bit too much of everything.
Because this is a character from the comics, right? Like, it used to be some KGB guy who who OD'd on stuff, right? In the original comics, yeah. And, I mean, for me, if you changed the face and took the arms off or made them smaller, you had the, you know, Godzilla, basically, from the Matthew Broderick era. That spine at the back, the, you know, it's like a burn victim crossed with Godzilla. But I'm willing to cut some slack that was from the production department and from the art director and not from the visual effects team. But there was, yeah, okay. I'm not going to win on this because there's nowhere I can go with it. I just didn't like it.
I'm not fighting you on that in any way, shape, or form because, you know, that's not a... it's not something I think can be defended. You know, it's very rare that you know, an effects house has a say in design other than going through multiple iterations of the designs coming out of the art department. You know, the art department a lot of times will do, I'm talking about the production company's art department, will do a lot of designs in 2D, and then when they go into the 3D realm, you'll start to see a lot of flaws in your design, and it'll evolve from there. But I think we can agree to agree on the point that the Abomination truly lived up to his name.
Yeah. So passing on him for a second, Kurt Williams was the visual effects supervisor, right? Am I right?
I believe so, yes.
Yeah. And so, look, in terms of an overall assessment of the visual effects, I think that full marks. Like, I think that they did a really good job. Had the film gone somewhere in the third act, I'd have been really enthusiastic. Kurt Williams himself is like got a very strong pedigree in doing stuff like this, like X-Files type stuff, and way back in the day, the original Batman stuff and Fantastic Four's X-Men. So, you know, obviously it's a genre that you need to have a good sense of what you can get away with in terms of the audience. Not enough and they feel ripped off too much and it becomes absurd and cartoony. You know, you want it to be fantastic, just not silly. And there are some incredibly hard lines to walk here. I mean, it's easier to sit on the sidelines as we do and criticize, but of course it is very, very hard to pull off these ridiculously outrageous kind of characters and then keep them still being both empathetic, frightening and a fan with the cult base that's followed them from years gone by. So I think he's done a good job. I think that the film probably for me is, you know, great until that third act. And I guess I was just so happy with it up until the end of the second act that I was just bitterly ripped off and disappointed by the third act. The CG, no doubt about it, really, really good. We should, I guess, give some credit to the other companies that contributed. Do you want to name some of the others? Because we mentioned Rhythm and Hughes, and they did do a great job, but there were other companies that contributed significantly to the film.
Yeah, I guess the biggest was up in Vancouver. You had what's the name of the company here? I have it down here somewhere.
Well, let me flag a couple of them. Hydraulics. Sorry, go on.
Yeah, Hydraulics and Image Engine were the two, I think, doing the big contributions to the film.
Yeah.
Outside of the news.
Yeah, and Hydraulics do really good work, and they were involved in the quite spectacular fiery crash of the Apache helicopter, which was again well done, and some digital doubles work and stuff. And of course, they've got a big strength, Hydraulics, in compositing, and apparently they did some pretty cool compositing in this. And their sister company, Lola, was involved, and Lola, you know, was in the X-Men and did the anti-aging at the beginning of the last one, which was just so magnificent. Unfortunately, Lola's effects tend to be on the hero actors when they're not monsters, and so you never actually get to find out what they did because it's almost like digital makeup. But whenever we do hear about what they've stuff done, it's so advanced. So I don't know, and I don't think you will ever find out precisely what Lola did, but whenever I see their name in the effects, I know that it'll be seamless because they do good work there. And there are a few other companies, you already mentioned some of the motion capture stuff, didn't you?
Yeah, Giant Studios did a lot of the motion capture, which, you know, I've had many, many dealings with Giant Studios over the past couple of years, and actually had the opportunity to meet Ed Norton when he was down at their studios filming some of the motion capture for this, and he's quite a nice guy, and very responsible. He drives a hydrogen-powered BMW.
Cool.
And he was taking care of a lot of the, you know, directing of the motion capture himself, and the motion coach for the film is a gentleman by the name of Terry Notary, who I've also had a history with, and he's also quite a fantastic, fantastically nice guy and very talented as well.
Now, because we're on to motion capture, you actually went to the VES night that was done on motion capture recently, didn't you?
I did, and I'm writing an article for FX Guide on it. And it was kind of a nice overview of the state of the technology at this point. They invited a lot of people from the Producers Guild and the Directors Guild to kind of come on by and see what was all about. And it was a nice evening.
Who was actually presenting at the at that?
Oh God, there's 10 names, so I know I'm gonna forget some people. Paul Debevec gave an amazing little preview of some stuff he's going to be showing off at SIGGRAPH this year with facial capture.
He is just an astoundingly nice guy, and anything he does is worth checking out. Yeah.
Yeah, he's kind of the underground genius of all the very cool effects that people have now have as a one button press in their applications, you know, from HDRI image mapping to what have you. And some of the stuff he's doing with his light spheres are pretty amazing.
Oh yeah, totally.
You had some people from Image Metrics. You had Vicon was there. You had John Meehan from Sony Pictures ImageWorks. You had let's see, who else was there? I don't have my notes in front of me.
Yeah, so it was a good representation. In other words,
it was a good representation from across the board of both vendors. You had people from Henson for people who are actually producing product with it. You had, you know, Giant Studios was there. You had Damian Gordon. You had Phase Space. You had a nice kind of cross section of the industry. So, and as I said, you know, I have a slight bias towards Giant Studios, having dealt with them in the past.
Well, but they're also exceptionally. I mean, you know, it's not a bias that isn't without basis in fact, right? I mean, they have a really good reputation.
Yeah, they have a fantastic reputation, and Giant Studios is also one of those companies. You know, they're a third party vendor that provides, you know, much like Gentle Giant or whatever, that provides services to the effects companies that a lot of times go unnoticed and unrecognized. But, you know, Giant has been a part of many, many films, you know, from I Am Legend to Iron Man to this, to the Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe films, to Polar Express over the years. That you know, they don't get nearly enough credit for the contribution that they do. They have a very talented group there.
Yeah, I think ILM was there as well, right? Doing their character, Mike Saunders.
Yeah, ILM was there talking a little bit about their iMocap system and how it works. It was nice. It was, each speaker was only given about 10 minutes to speak, so you didn't get a lot of depth to it. And then when they opened up to Q&A, devolve is the wrong word because that seems like you're taking it to a level below. But a lot of questions kind of came up about the rights of actors and who owns the data and that kind of stuff. That was, I thought, quite interesting.
Personally, I think motion capture, enormous promise in the early days, didn't go fulfilled for quite a while, fell into almost mockery, and then has come back now over the last, 5 to 7 years, to be incredibly high fidelity, really good material. And and without the vast problems that we saw in the early days where you were getting just such rudimentary stuff after you cleaned up the data that it really wasn't worth doing in the first place. And I know that you can't talk about the work you're doing, but certainly moving forward, we're expecting a whole rash of really great advances in this area. And it's good because, you know, to a certain extent, it's letting the actors participate in a whole different way than just having character animators doing the performances through through key poses.
So, right. It's a tool like any other. I think it kind of fell into the problem in its early days of people thinking it was a plug-and-play solution. You know, we go for the motion, and then we apply the motion to our characters, and we're done. And that's so not the case.
What was that initial system that everyone bought that no one ever used? Like Flock of, I'm going to say Flock of Seagulls, but it wasn't. Flock of something. Do you remember that one?
Flock of, I believe it's what's called Flock of Birds.
That's right. People would buy these rigs for like a couple of a couple hundred thousand dollars, and it would be a loom of wires that you would hang off an actor. And I knew a few post houses that bought them, did like one job with them, and then they never got used again.
Yeah, I mean, the you have either active or passive. You know, I don't want to devolve into a talk about mocap, but you have a couple of different basic philosophies on motion capture. But the end result is simply data put onto a skeleton, and what you do with that really becomes less a technical choice and more of an artistic choice at that point. The technology is there. It really is to take motion from the real world and record it into the computer with incredible fidelity. It's just a matter of what do you do with it at that point and how do you treat it and where do you go from there. And then it becomes an issue with all your other issues, such as, you know, you can have incredibly realistic body motion at the skeletal level, but if you don't have great deformations on top of that and great simulation of cloth and hair on top of that and wonderful rendering of skin and hair and eyes on top of that, you know, then it starts falling apart. So you can The technology is for driving motion is getting to the same point where it has been to the same point for a while. It's just a matter of getting the technology for all the rendering and all the driving of the surfaces from that skeletal data further and further and further. So the big push right now in motion capture, to kind of wrap up this little talk, is it's all about real time. You know, instead of having your data go into the system, and then if you have a large army of trackers to throw at it, getting it a week later, you know, it's you put your person out there in a suit and you look down at the monitor and you see your character moving. And right then and there. And, you know, that's what the giant system really excels at. So it makes it very director friendly.
I think the other thing that, and I mean, I know it sounds like you're apologizing for discussing this, but I actually think it's really valid. It's not just the real time thing that's driving the. There's only three or four interesting areas of motion capture. I mean, another one is markerless motion capture systems, and still another is, you know, doing motion capture from either just one or two cameras, but in particular like one camera being the film camera and deriving three-dimensional kind of motion from that. There's in my mind, quite a few interesting research areas in motion capture. It isn't one of those technologies that's got to a point, I think, that's matured and is stabilized. It seems to be still growing in leaps and bounds.
Oh, it's absolutely growing in leaps and bounds. The way I look at motion capture kind of is, it's kind of where modeling or rendering was in, you know, the mid-90s, where it's now at a point where it's production proven. You have a method that works and that you can, you know, always fall back on, but you can keep kind of pushing forward and trying to make new discoveries and pushing the technology forward. Whereas you look at the rendering back in the mid-90s, and sometimes now you look back and it's laughably bad, but it served its purpose and sold the movie. And you're going to look at the same thing with motion capture now, where in 10 years we may look back and say, oh my God, that looks laughably bad, or the methods that we use to capture it may have seemed ancient, but The end results hopefully will hold up at the end of the day. They actually, I believe, on Hulk did use the new system from MOVA called Contour to do some of the facial capture, which is a really, you know, they kind of have caught a lot of the motion capture people by storm, because they use a markerless system of random phosphorescent makeup patterns on the actor's face to capture incredible amounts of surface detail, and convert that into a usable data set. The company is located up in San Francisco, and they're really doing some fantastic R&D and applying that to real world solutions. It's pretty nice.
Yeah, no, definitely. Well, I find motion capture to be totally fascinating. But as you said before, the idea of going to real time isn't just about, you know, okay, it was a bit slow before and we sped up the processes and we have new, faster, better, whatever. The problem with before was like a quantum leap, because, you know, it was deadly slow to actually just sift through the data to get meaningful stuff out of it to clean it up. And it wasn't like a, you know, get it going from X to X times two. It was like X to a fraction of X. Wouldn't you agree?
Absolutely. You know, I'm very much trying to couch what I say here.
I'm not going for what you're working on now, but I mean, just in general terms, right? Like in any normal motion capture system of a few years ago, there was a vast amount of data cleanup just to get something manageable to actually use.
Yeah, it was a vast amount of data cleanup. You know, we're aided by a lot of different things. We're aided by increases in software, you know, solutions, higher resolution of cameras, faster computers. But I remember 6 years ago coming down to House of Moves and doing a facial session that was less than 2 minutes long. I'd markered myself up to, I didn't marker myself up, DJ Hawk did. But, you know, I got the markers on my own face and, you know, we did a simple 8-camera setup and did about 2.5 minutes of facial capture, and House of Moves was wonderful and got that data to me. You know, we captured on a Friday and they got it delivered to me on Monday of the following week. But nowadays you can expect to see that, you know, perfectly cleaned up by the end of the day, if not sooner. And apply that to whatever facial system you're using and see it on your character. You know, you can take that kind of facial data, throw it into something like FaceRobot, and have your character, you know, fully deforming, you know, within a few hours, which is it's an aid not only to the artists who are working on it because they're getting their results quicker, but it's an aid to both the performer and the director. To so they know what they have to do in order to get the performance they want out of the character.
Yeah, no, absolutely, it's really well used when you have something like a clear mapping between a, you know, biped model of a computer model like the Hulk and of course a normal actor, because the translation works very well and you can obviously map to different. To different, you know, dimensions and different lengths of arms and stuff. But in this particular film, in The Hulk, it's going to work really well because, you know, you've got an actor acting out the motions and their range of movement is pretty much the same as what the Hulk is, albeit he can pick up a couple of cards and rip them in half at the same time and sort of shuffle them like cards. It's still the same kind of fundamental joint system. And so it tends to scale well, tends to be used well, and I think the guys in this film used it well.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other aid that's kind of coming along with it is you start getting more and more stunt performers and motion experts and even actors who have extensive experience working with the medium. So they know what to expect. They know what they have to do in order to get the performance needed. When you call for T-pose, they know what you're talking about. They know when they come in the morning that they're going to spend half their morning in a chair getting, you know, uncomfortable markers put on their face or what have you, and be out there in a very silly looking suit. So the, you know, I think a lot of the kind of weirdness and what have you of the process has been subjugated to just worrying about, you know, getting your performance what you need it. You know, I keep coming back to that word, but that's why I think a lot of motion capture people are moving away from calling it motion capture and more terming it performance capture, because, you know, capturing motion is easy. Capturing a performance is quite a bit more difficult, you know, and getting all those subtleties of what the body does in order to portray an emotion, it can be difficult, you know, but it always, not freaks me out, but it's always amazing to me that you can look at a monitor and see a cluster of markers, you know, absolutely no skeletal structure or whatever, just the marker data floating there in space, and your brain will put it together automatically to be the human being, and you can see what they're doing just by, you know, the human brain is built to recognize that motion and apply an emotion and a feeling to it. So it's being able to take that and apply it to something that's decidedly non-human, that's the challenge nowadays, and to still have that emotion come across.
Yeah, good point. And that's a good point, I think, to leave it in our discussion this week of the Hulk. David, thank you so much for taking time to go through that with us. We really appreciate it.
Absolutely.
And what were you... Are you performing? Are you...
I am performing when I stand-up comedy when I'm able to. My schedule is rather busy right now between Avatar and I'm working on two short films right now that hopefully I'll be getting done before the fall.
I saw some remarks about one of those on your Twitter posts.
Your associate Jason Wingrove, it was kind of, we were twittering back and forth. And I offered to write him something, and so I got to get in contact with him, and he said he'd love to see whatever I have to put together. So, you know, I love to write. He loves to direct. It might work out well.
Sounds good. And, of course, from my point of view, we're going to see you cross over with this article you're writing for us for FX Guide. And if you're interested in finding out more about that, it'll be at www.fxguide.com in the coming weeks. Where we have quite a lot of good stuff at the moment, and we've just started a new term over at FX PhD, and the new term basically being the start of a 10-11 week period where we put out new material, and now's a great time to join up if you're interested in filmmaking, and that's at fxphd.com where you'll find me.
The class listing for this coming term is quite impressive, actually.
Thanks, man. We appreciate it.
I wish I had a little bit more free time to be able to take some classes.
I've just been doing the miniatures and motion and stop motion stuff, and oh my god, is that fun or what? I mean, it's just absolutely like kid in a candy store for me. God, I had a ball doing that. So, yeah, I just got from shooting a bunch of that, so it's great fun.
That's what I wanted to do. That's what got me into this industry in the first place.
Me
back
too.
Growing up, is I wanted to build miniatures.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I was saying the other day, I bought an old Cinefix on, I collect them, right? And I bought one on eBay, and it arrived just the other day, and it was the issue 3, which was all about the stop frame animation in Star Wars. I'm going to say episode 2, but it's actually episode 5, but the second one that came out. And yeah, it was great reading that and listening to the words of people like Dennis Muren from what was, I guess, 20 years ago. But it's such a funny thing because he leads the whole article off by pointing that stop motion tends to polarize people. They either love it or they hate it, but I certainly love it. I think it's great.
I think it's fantastic.
Okay, well, until next time, I want to thank our producers and the team at Pixel Corp for putting the program together and for doing our production as well as our research. We appreciate that, and we'll be hooking up with you all pretty soon, and we'll be doing another one of these, which we have a couple of interesting films slated for production. We've got both Wanted and Get Smart on the list, and I'm particularly interested to discuss these because one was shot on the Red and one was shot on Genesis. And apart from anything else in the films in terms of visual effects, I'm keen to discuss the cinematography in both of those. But that's coming up in weeks to come. Until next time, I'm Mike Seymour on behalf of myself and you, David.
Absolutely.
We'll see you guys later. Okay, thanks, guys. Bye.